SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We acknowledge the people of Ngāi Iwi of Te Wai Pōnamu, Aotearoa, who welcomed Alone Australia onto their land. And we acknowledge the Cammeraygal people as the traditional owners of the land we're recording on. We pay deepest respect to First Nations elders, past and present, and all First Nations people.
G'day, this is the Alone Australia podcast. I am Darren Mara.
And I'm Gina Chick, winner of season one. Hello, armchair aloners. Each week, Darren and I are watching the show with you. We're having a chat with the people involved, breaking down all the highs and lows, and going behind the scenes to get some of the stuff you don't see on the telly.
And this week, we're going to chat with Jack a little bit. And we're also going to hear from a psychologist who's actually worked as a consultant for the show. But first, there's a lot I want to ask you, Gina, about episode 5.
And I can't wait to get into it. I can't believe how involved I am in this. It's so good to be on this side of the telly shouting at it. And let's get ready to pull it all apart.
Sunshine, thunderstorms, two stonkers. The participants made it past the 14-day mark. We started with 6. We ended with 5. I want to start with Andreas today. He caught 2 amazing fish. It brought me so much joy to see him bring them in, particularly the second one, which he had to fight really hard for.
I am armchair aloning so hard. I'm shouting at the TV. I'm screaming at the participants. I'm so on the edge of my seat that it's almost unbearable to watch. And I'm so loving where the participants are going. And yes, Andreas's fish. It's just so amazing to see his innate hunting wisdom, really.
He did it really easily.
Well, I think that he's just got so much hunting wisdom that it's like when he first saw the possum, like he went out, saw the possum, killed the possum. Mm. As soon as he saw the fish, he chucked a line out, got the fish, but then he didn't stop there. He like did another rig, made a fly fishing rod, saw another fish, got that fish as well. Like, I'm so impressed with the way he's able to just work with the landscape, bring in the food.
We got that story, his backstory, how he would fish with his father. Mm. So it's clearly something that he's done his whole life and is very important to him. Mm. He brought the fish back to his camp, tied them up. They were huge fish. What would you do now with those fish?
Well, obviously, you need to preserve it. To land that kind of food and then have it spoil is so heartbreaking. They're lucky they don't have any predators, so it's not like you're going to have to worry about a wolf coming and stealing your food. But bacteria are going to do a better job anyway. And we see him really wrestling with that. You know, salt is a part of this episode as well. He doesn't have any, obviously. So when he doesn't have a fire, then he doesn't have any way of preserving his fish.
You brought salt onto season one and you had great success with it. I found it strange that so far we only know that Jack has brought salt.
Yeah, well, maybe we just haven't seen it yet. Mind you, I think I was only the second person ever to bring salt and it totally saved my ass. But for Andreas, it would definitely be something that he would be sort of wanting right now. But the great thing about salt is it makes bush tucker taste good. And as we see with Christoph, you know, and by the way, I've got to say, I'm loving Christoph's.
He's chill.
He is so chill. Yeah. His mindset is so great. You know, he's out there eating the completely unpalatable food in the form of seaweed, pretty much. And I love that he says, basically, this is garbage. It tastes like garbage, but maybe I can just keep eating it and it's going to taste better. If that's not glass half full, I don't know what is.
Yeah, we're getting a bit of the philosophy of Christoph. I loved his analogy about boiling water, unsettled water. You got to let it settle down.
Yeah.
Take time to make your decisions. He seems to be like he's in a really good mental place.
Yeah. I'm curious as why we haven't seen him until now, really. I suspect it's a technical issue because, you know, if for some reason you're out there solo filming yourself and there is some kind of a technical stuff up, then it just might be that there's no footage. But I'm really glad to meet him. And considering he hasn't eaten for over 2 weeks, he is so cruisy and so chill. I just hope he gets more than garbage greens to eat.
Mm. This episode, we saw Jack tap out. Mm. He passed his medical, but then he opted to leave while he was still in relatively good nick. Mm. It seemed like he had the tech, he had the knowledge, the experience. What do you think went wrong for him?
I wouldn't say it's going right or going wrong. Again, it's one of those things that when we're in our lounge rooms and we're focused on how many days can someone last, it can feel like there's a right way and a wrong way. Whereas when you're out there, it just becomes a process and every choice has consequences and you learn what those consequences are and then you have to make more choices. So what I see with Jack is he is like Inspector Gadget. He has come up with such amazing creations that you can obviously see the part of him that is the innovator. And it'd be very easy to speculate why he hasn't caught game or why he hasn't caught a fish. But what I really want to focus on is how clear he was about his decision. Well, there's so much pressure when we're out there to stay as many days as possible. I love that he was so clear. He was like, no, I'm the provider for my family. I need to look after my health. I'm going to have to go back and support my family and work, and I need to do that in a way that I'm actually healthy. And he really backed himself, and I loved how philosophical he was at the end there for what might have been a disappointing thing for him. But I really felt like he took everything that he could from the experience.
Yeah, we wish Jack well.
Yeah.
Susan, 5 days of gastro.
Oh, my God.
She revealed. Can you imagine that?
Oh, I don't know about you. I've had a 3-day gastro and afterwards I was munted for a week. Mm. I mean, I could barely get out of bed. But what I noticed with her is, did you see how beautiful she looks, like how sort of like translucent and clear? Mm. And I'm kind of wondering if it's almost a bit like the land just kind of like violently expressed itself through her to clear out all of the stuff that's in the way so that she can be really landed. Like, I feel like the before the gastro and after the gastro is such a clear demarcation of her being absolutely right here. Mm. And seeing how she moved her shelter after 5 days of gastro, I mean, that is superwoman status.
Mm, yeah, and what do you think about her new location? It seems to be sunnier.
So much better.
Yeah.
So much better. I was a bit dubious about her moving because it is such a calorie burn. Mm. And I thought that after gastro, that might take her out. But she looks like she's actually thriving.
Well, how important is it for her now to try and get some protein?
Well, just any food in her system.
Yeah.
I mean, she looks like she's got some mass to lose, which can be one of the things that as a woman, it's like it's easier for us often to hold weight, especially postmenopausal or perimenopausal women. So she's got some reserves, but she will have stripped them right back along with her stomach lining. So, yeah, getting something in her belly right now would be pretty important.
Mm. Rick had a rather inventive way of trying to dry out his boots with hot stones, and Tamika decided to hang up her bow. Mm. Where do you see those two guys at right now?
So Rick, he's so seasoned. Like, he is so seasoned.
We should tell everyone we're referring to him as Uncle Rick right now. I mean, he's like everybody's
favourite uncle. Yeah. Actually, and I've got to say that even though he's in a bit of a dip, he's still funny as fuck, you know. He still comes out with stuff that genuinely makes me laugh.
Rickisms.
Yeah. Mm. So he is kind of like everyone's favourite uncle. But with what's going on with his shoes, that's just got to be really hard. And getting so wet that he's now looking at hypothermia. When I was out there in Lutruwita in Tassie, I ended up probably 3/4 of the way through having a fish get snagged and making the choice to dive down 3 meters into almost freezing water to try and retrieve it. And I'd already been in the water maybe 3 times, I think, already and warmed up really easily. But after that one, my body fat was low, it was late in the competition. And when I came out, I didn't get the fish. But also I got cold, like proper bone cold. Mm. And it actually took me a week.
A week.
And that's sitting around
by fires. Campfire.
Yeah. I just couldn't get warm. I was cold at night. I was shivering. And it was a week later that there was like this beautiful sunny day and I lay on a log with no clothes on and just actually got my bones warm. So I can really see how one event that drops your body temperature enough to put you in the hypothermic zone can have consequences that, you know, really ripple. So I'm crossing my fingers that Rick can get through it. He's such a steady Eddie. Mm. I reckon that, you know, he'll come through.
And Tamika hanging up the bow, is that a good move?
Yeah, I think for her it is. Mm. Absolutely. I mean, I'm assuming she's going to fish. The thing that I see with her is something that I'm seeing now at this sort of like at this stage of the experience. The participants are now deeply interacting with nature and they're meeting their stories, they're meeting their judgments and their projections, they're meeting their identity. Mm. And in the mirror of wild nature, we meet ourselves and it's like our stories can't hold up. And they dissolve little bit by little bit by little bit. And what I see with Tamika is she's come up hard against the expectation that she had that she was going to be able to hunt for food. And she's found the place where it's like, no, in my integrity, in my authenticity, I can't do this. And so there's some emotion in that, but it means that she's going to be super clear going forward, knowing that, like, I can't do that. That's then off the table. So there's no calories to burn or waste, even worrying about it. Mm. And now I'm thinking she's probably going to focus on fishing. If she doesn't want to fish as well, then I reckon she's probably going to be in strife.
Tradesman and wild game hunter Jack, he's been hunting most of his life, but after 2 weeks on Alone Australia Season 2 and some unsuccessful hunting and fishing attempts, his risk appetite, let's say, dropped a little bit. We've got Jack with us now from his home in Victoria to share a bit more about his experience, and we can see that he's with his trusty hunting companion, Leah, who I understands Spanish exclusively.
Yeah, she's been trained with Spanish. No, it's good to keep her away from other people as well, and in case. But she understands Spanish and very, very good companion dog.
And you're in the garden as well.
Yeah, in my backyard. I tried to make a forest in my backyard, you see.
Now, you brought salt in as one of your items, which I totally cheer and relate to.
Mm.
Can you tell us, you know, your reasoning about that? Do you use salt in your other hunting expeditions? Tell us about that philosophy.
I actually had it daily, just a little bit in the water and in my teas. It helps hydrate me as well. And there's minerals in there as well. But mainly for hydration. I get migraines if I get dehydrated too much. And if I hunt something, I can use it to cure, to dry out the meat and then make it last longer.
When I was out there, I originally took salt because I thought I could use it as a bait to, you know, because in the Northern Hemisphere you get deer licks and that kind of thing. And it was hilarious because none of the wallabies gave a shit about my salt. They were just like, they just didn't care. But I found that it was fantastic because it did keep my blood pressure up. And of course, you know, you can get medically tapped once you're fasting and your blood pressure drops. You can actually get medically tapped for having low blood pressure. So it was one of those accidental things for me. It was like, oh my goodness, this thing that I thought was for one thing was something else. And I must admit, I cheered a bit when I saw that you had salt. I was like, yes, brother. Go the salt.
I also used it as a bait. I was hoping for some possums. I did set some up. I kept it out there for a few days and just kept going back and having a look, but it was untouched.
Jack, you mentioned that you're susceptible to migraines. How big of a factor was that for you? Did that play on your mind when you were heading over there, thinking that that could possibly strike while you're, in isolation?
It's almost like a kryptonite, like a disability having migraines. But I don't let it stop me doing anything that I want to do. I go out hunting. I've had migraines out there, and I just have to endure it. I do have some medication for it and stuff, but I've had migraines for 50 years.
Did you have any migraines when you were out there?
Not a single one. The week before, I had 3 or 4. Since I went out there, I didn't have a single one.
Why do you think that was?
When I got back into my normal diet, I started getting migraines again. And I thought, no, something is going on here. So I started doing a 15, 17-hour fast daily and reduced my sugars dramatically, like the diet that they put us on after we, to recuperate, and high protein. And for 7 months now, I haven't had a single migraine. First time in my life.
Wow.
Every month I'd get 2 or 3 migraines at least.
And that's your whole life?
The whole life, 50 years. And now 7 months, yep, without a single migraine. I have my dinner at 7 p.m. I have my lunch at 11 or 12 and hydrate since the morning and low sugar, low carbs, high protein and veggies. That's it.
You went out on a loan for whatever, you know, the reasons that you went out, and yet...
Because it's my favourite show. It's my favourite show. I've seen every single one. I think it's the greatest competition that there is on TV.
So why did you go on it, apart from it being your favourite show?
Because it's what I do. I go hunting on my own where I can bring Leah along. We go as well. I do go with mates now and then as well. But, I go hunting on my own, and I love the outdoors. I love being outdoors. To me, that's real life. Suburbia and four walls, that's the matrix. The world that we live in is unique in the universe. And that's what I enjoy. I enjoy being out there. Yeah.
You said going into the show that you had no fears with this great challenge ahead of you, but did anything end up scaring you while you were out there?
Okay, since you ask me, the only fear that I had, might sound strange, is that a war would break out. I had two jet fighters going over me. That's the only thing that I got fearful of, and not being home, nothing else.
That's hard.
That's the only thing that I was fearful of. The other thing is not fearful, but it's managing the risks of breaking a leg or something like that. I've never broken a bone in my life. Dirt biking, hunting, kayaking, and you manage the risks. But my family expect me to come home. They're used to me coming back home safe.
Jack, you said that innovation is one of your greatest skills. And one of the things that we didn't get to see was your shelter. Tell us a little bit about your shelter and perhaps some of the other tools that you made.
Well, I'm always out looking for different types of shelters, and I ran into this one on YouTube, and some of the famous YouTube guys, army guys, have used it and designed it, and I thought that's a very, very innovative shelter because you're protected in nearly all four sides, down low so it doesn't catch the wind. And I actually opened up the back to allow some cross breeze so that to dry out things inside. But while I was in there, never got wet, sturdy, low profile, so the wind just goes right over it. And I used the camera bag at the entrance. Yeah, innovation. It's learning stuff from primitive cultures as well. And we call them primitive, but I find them pretty advanced. Like, people find it hard to work out how to do things when in the past people have already learnt stuff to survive and make their life comfortable. And we need to relearn a lot of things, a lot of basic things like that. Yeah.
Now, we've got a question from a fan, Lindsay. And Lindsay asks, you were getting absolutely eaten by sandflies. Did you regret the shorts decision?
Yeah. New Zealand is new to me. You know, I hunt in the high country. I don't have any sandflies up there. The worst that I get is leeches. And in the swampy areas around Gippsland, mozzies. So I don't regret it because it helps me regulate my temperature. I'm in shorts now. You know, I'm always in shorts. And for me, it's just very comfortable, and also helps get vitamin D's and so on. And to me, it's just normal. Yesterday, I think it was, 15, 16 degrees. And I'm just with a T-shirt and shorts, especially at this time in autumn. I like to just wear T-shirt and shorts to acclimatise, to get myself prepared for winter hunts. So reduce the suffering as well.
And then we get to New Zealand, which has sandflies like Australians have no idea. Like, these are Terminator sandflies. You cannot understand what it's like to get nailed by Aotearoa sandflies until you have actually achieved that. But I've got a question for you. I heard a rumour that you slept in the buff when you were out there.
Not only out there.
Was there any part of your body that didn't get nailed by sandflies?
No.
Oh, no.
Ouch.
Yeah.
I don't want to know.
That's got to hurt.
I unzipped, even when it's like freezing, I unzip, and sometimes I've got a leg out.
You were like a full buffet for the midges, full body buffet.
Yeah, you paid the price. Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't have a full-on mozzie net, you know, and they hurt and they burn. It felt like it was burning. And by the way, I got attacked on my legs mainly when I was making my bed, because I was focused on trying to get the bed done, because that was 4 days into it where I just kept waking up during the night because the sand was wet and cold and hard. So made a bed with paracord and also dug a hole so that the paracord can, you know, sink a bit into the hole. And then it was comfortable. But it cost me. While I was just focused on that, they were all over me and they took advantage.
Got smashed.
Jack, we have another listener question. This one's from Margot from Sydney. First of all, she says, love alone, love you guys, love the podcast. What would stop a participant catching and eating something that's not allowed? For example, an eel, you know, when the cameras aren't rolling. Is it just an honesty system? Or is there some way of making sure people don't get an unfair advantage?
Well, yeah, I think it's not only an honesty system. I mean, I go hunting in the high country. There's stuff that you're not allowed to take, and I just don't take it. And there's the issue of being able to live with yourself. You know, it's a competition. Everyone's supposed to have the same restrictions. When I was setting up my tents, there was some beautiful chicken-looking thing trying to undo my paracord. You know, and I could just picture it. It was the first day, but I could just picture it on the fire. But, yeah, we're not allowed to have it. I did see a couple of geese, and it wasn't shown there, but, yeah, I was trying to sneak up to the Canadian geese. I only saw two ever in the time that I was there, but we were allowed to have those. But they just laughed at me and took off, so I was trying to sneak up.
Now, Jack, I was really moved by your decision-making process. When you shared what was going through your mind as you made the decision to leave and go back. And what I was struck by was like how much responsibility you have in your life, like, and how important that is to you. And I'm just wondering, like, is that something that's cultural? Did you get that from your dad? Is that something that you've just sort of like grown in your life? It was very obvious that that was a huge factor, and you approached that so clearly as well.
Well, my parents have always been providing, and we always gone out together and camping together and stuff. So to me, it's just normal. I don't want to get home and have to be looked after. It's just a thing that I have to be prepared and I have to be as safe as possible. Yeah, I go dirt biking. I've done 197 k's an hour on my dirt bike, but within your abilities, I do everything that I want to do because we only have one life. Do it, but within your abilities so that you don't end up messed up, you know, and I don't want to end up messed up, yeah.
You said that you knew you'd tried your best that day that you tapped out. How do you feel now looking back?
Yeah, I did do my best. I didn't spend any daylight hours in my shelter. I was out when it was raining and pouring and windy and stuff. I was out. I'd find a tree, go into the protected side of the tree and just stay there. I'm fishing and going through the game trails looking for fresh sign and following them up. So I did not stand still, and I actually lost about 800 grams every day. I lost all the weight that I put on and some when I left. So I didn't want to just sit there. I could have sat there for another week or so, but it's not what I went there for. I went there to try and find something. You've got to make the plans. My brother-in-law is a hunter as well. We've been hunting since we were 15, 16 years old. We had the plan of, you need to get the energy, you need to get that fat in to be able to, because my plan was to spend the night up in the mountains, up high, but you can't just go up there with an empty belly and the higher you go, you get a storm and you're going to get snow, you're going to get cold and that's dangerous. So my plan was to get food first and hopefully preserve some and then take off up higher. We don't have a map of the area, so we don't know where things are. You know, and we didn't see it from the sky. We only saw it from water level. And so you need to do a lot of exploration to be able to see, okay, the deer are spending the night over there or they're feeding over here. And that's what I do up in the high country. And it takes many trips to be able to work everything out. And when you don't have the energy to spare to do that, it can be dangerous. You could end up leaving earlier. And if you don't have the energy and you're taking your backpack with all the safety gear in there and some water and stuff, then you risk of getting injured.
It's such a balancing act, isn't it? So, Jack, I wanted to just ask about your daughters. It seems to me that you really consciously role model for your daughters. I'm just wondering what you wanted to show them when you were out there, what you wanted to teach them, and also how did they feel when they were seeing you on the telly?
When I was going, it's almost anticlimactic because they said, yeah, it's just another hunt. Dad's just going on another hunt. That's it. They were very supportive. And my wife actually said, it'll be sad to see you there all alone, you know, in the campfire and stuff. But that's what I've been doing for 30 years. But she doesn't see it because there's no...
So finally, they got to see what you actually do out
there. Yeah, that's right. Got a fire going. There's nothing around you. And but that's just normal for me, you know. And it's baby steps. It's not just like all of a sudden I'm out there like that. That's why for some people it's a bit of a shock because they're not used to it. But my mum said, you'll be all right. You've been camping in the backyard since you were 10 years old, you know. And to me, it's baby steps that desensitize to that sort of environment. Yeah.
Jack, the next section to this conversation is our quick fire round where we fire 10 quick questions at you and we'd like to try and answer as quickly as you can. So if you're ready, the first question is, what was the favorite of your 10 items?
My knife.
What was your biggest surprise out there?
The size of some of the eels, like that. Huge eels, yeah.
That you weren't allowed to eat?
Not. I wanted to shoot with a bow or something. We weren't allowed to have it, yeah.
Who or what did you miss most?
I go hunting as often as I can with Nia, and, yeah, it would have been awesome to have her there, but I would definitely not take her if I see her hungry. Never.
Who inspires you?
I guess it's not a single person, but it's a combination of people that I've seen in my life. Is my parents looking after the family and my in-laws as well, as they're a very close family. That's important to me.
What's your favourite thing to hunt, Jack?
My favourite thing to hunt is rabbits.
What was your biggest lesson out there?
You know, what I did learn is, because I've never fasted for so long, and I actually thought after 3 days I'm going to be like out of it. But the body adapts and just push on. And that's what amazed me, how that's the biggest lesson, how your body can adapt and keep going.
What's your favourite camping spot?
I'm not going to tell you my favourite camping spot. But
I need some tips.
If you ever get the chance, the Mitchell River National Park in Victoria. It's an amazing isolated place. I love going hunting in the middle of the week when there's no one. But you've got a huge river, there's trout in there, there's deer all over the place, and you can hunt in one half of it.
What was the favourite thing that you built out there?
Oh, the shelter. Mm. Yeah, the shelter was excellent. I practiced making the shelter here, and it's basically like a tent and completely enclosed and protected. The shelter for sure.
What would you tell someone, Jack, who's thinking of applying for a loan?
Check out, if you want to, you know, go as far as you can, practice fasting, you know, put yourself to the test. You know, go for a week doing your same job and everything, hydrate properly, and you've got to go for a week without eating.
Would you do it again?
I tried to apply for season 3.
He's like, let me back. Let me have another crack.
Yes, yeah.
Climb a mountain or swim a lake?
Climb a mountain. Yep. One of my favourite spots is... near a place called Sheepyard Flat, where I can see Mount Buller, and completely alone again, hunting up on the ridges and stuff, and I don't get tired because I go hunting with food as well.
So. That's the secret.
And a dog.
And a
buddy.
Yeah, that's it.
Jack, thanks so much for talking to us, mate. Thanks for your insights. It was amazing watching you on the show.
over the last 5 weeks. It's so good to hear about the migraines and how they're no longer a problem for you with the, you know, the, your newfound way of life.
That's my trophy from Alone.
Absolutely.
My trophy from Alone is not getting migraines, and hopefully the message can get out to some people to give it a go. It costs you nothing. In fact, it's going to cost you less money and no drugs. It's like if I piled all the drugs that I've had over the last 50 years, it would kill a couple of elephants.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Well, yep. Might end up with your own wellness channel. Jack, thank you so much. And I really also just want to acknowledge like how striking your clarity was through that whole process and how beautiful it was to see you come to your decision to leave and really, really own it. I was really touched watching you. So thank you so much for bringing yourself so that we could all experience you.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Psychologist Mark Matheson, he's worked as a sport and performance psychologist. Then he worked in the Special Forces as well. He works as a consultant on Alone Australia as well. And he is a specialist in an area that I know absolutely nothing about, which is eco-psychology. We've got him here to find out exactly what that is and what being alone in the wilderness does to our brains.
And I am very excited to be on this side of the couch because Mark has interviewed me many times leading into and on the other side of Alone Australia. And for the first time, I get to be the one asking the questions. So Mark, can you please tell us, what's eco-psychology?
For sure. And look, lovely to chat to you again, Gina. I guess eco-psychology is certainly a new field here in Australia. It's only been around for the last probably 5 or 10 years in any form, but it's been around a long time. It's a fascinating field, one that I came to really late in my career in many ways after doing all those other lovely things in working with special forces and the military and the corporate world. But eco-psychology is really the study of how we connect or reconnect with nature. And it really came out of the sort of the swinging 60s in the US, where a group of academics started to really look into that connection in the early 70s. It's grown from there. It's a bit bigger in the UK than in the US now, but it's really come out to Australia in force in the last 5 or 10 years. And it really is fascinated with how we can really reconnect or come to learn a bit about how we form part of nature.
I find it particularly interesting, you know, within the context of Australia, because we're such an urbanized nation, such a huge proportion of Australians live in big cities, concrete jungles. I'm one of them. How do you go about trying to connect someone like me, for example, who was born and raised in Sydney, with the natural environment, with land outside of the city? Or is it not even outside the city? Can you do it inside the city?
For sure. And look, I think the secret answer is nature's in all of us. But look, Sydney is a great place to talk about because in many ways, Sydney has some fantastic bits of nature that we can all reconnect to. I mean, the beaches are fabulous. There's some amazing national parks right on your doorstep. So nature is all around us and we're interacting with it pretty much all day, every day. And often it's a case of not necessarily having to go somewhere, although that can help. Certainly going on holidays to some amazing, beautiful places makes it much easier to sort of recognize where nature starts and I guess where we stop. But it's a case of bringing it into awareness and saying, well, I probably interact with nature in many ways, small and large. Even having plants in your home is a good way of actually starting to reconnect with nature and the cycles and patterns that plants involve. But it's all around us and it's a case of bringing it to people's awareness and then really getting them to, I guess, relax into it and see that it's part of their life anyway.
How does eco-psychology relate to Alone?
Great question. I mean, the nature of the show, as you probably already know, is about people being alone. But really, they're not alone if you want to think about it in the context of the fact that nature's all around them. In fact, they're immersed in it. Eco-psychology is really about reforming that relationship with nature. I mean, yes, it has some sort of very fancy science around it and a lot of it's down at the subatomic level. But at a, I guess, a human level, it's about being comfortable with nature and understanding the patterns and cycles that fluctuate in and out of it. And so alone is really an experiment in some ways about recognizing whether you are alone. And for some people, they are, and the draw of the human connection is greater. And for others, you know, they're really able to, I guess, form and build on that connection with nature that they're immersed in.
So you have been like a consultant on quite a few survival shows now. What I'm curious about is, are there some common things that people run into where they go, like, this is, I'm going to be good at this and this and this, but this is the thing that they like fall over? Like, you know, do you see some common threads in that?
Oh, I think an over-reliance on the technical skills and an under-reliance or an under-appreciation of how much of a social mammal we really are. And it's really started to reframe my psychology practice. I really now believe that we weren't designed for self-care. We're designed for mutual care. Mm-hmm. And in fact, our brains work in almost, you know, interconnected ways. Our personality evolves because of the interactions we have with other people. It's not something that just happens inside us. And so is it any surprise that when you take all of that away, people suddenly notice a big void? It's like, oh my God, I'm actually alone. And for many people, that's the first experience they've had of that. And it scares the crap out of them because all of your sympathetic nervous system goes into panic mode. Mm. And that comes from evolution. We knew that if we were left alone by the tribe, if we were left out in the wilderness, we were likely to die. We don't survive well as individuals. And so, yeah, at a subconscious level, your brain knows when you're alone that you're at risk. Mm. And if you haven't worked that skill, if you haven't trained that a little bit, or at least learned to soothe it and go, no, it's okay, we're not actually alone, nature's here, and you know, we know that pattern too, then it tends to freak out.
I felt it when I was out there, that difference between the idea of being apart from nature or a part of nature. And having gone back and, you know, watched all of the North American series, plus now looking at this series coming up, it's really interesting to see the people who just feel like they're part of nature and what that relaxation does to their time out there.
Mm, absolutely. And look, it's not obviously unique to a lion. There's plenty of other environments where sometimes it's more, I guess, more obvious. I mean, I've worked with Antarctic expeditioners and they're often in awe of the nature at first. But the longer they're there, the more they're able to see the patterns and the cycles around them and realize that they just have to fit in with some of those patterns because, you know, nature can be fairly brutal down in Antarctica. And if you don't take notice of what those patterns are, weather patterns, for example, it can really do you some harm, if not kill you. So it's a case of sometimes recognizing the patterns around you, which is easier and harder depending on geography and terrain and your familiarity with those patterns. But they're always there. The sun comes up most days in most places and it goes down. And so, you know, we are synchronized really at a very cellular level with those patterns. It's just a case of learning them or relearning them in some cases and then being able to work with them or sometimes working against them because, you know, there's occasions where our lives don't let us.
I spend a fair bit of time at the beach. You know, I take the dog for a walk to the park. I try to walk to work where I can and I walk through some lovely wooded areas. And I mean, there's obviously the benefits of the exercise aspect to that. Mm. But being surrounded by greenery, being in the natural environment, looking out at an ocean and being in nature, what is that actually doing to the brain, to my brain? How is that beneficial at, you know, a chemical level or a subatomic level, as you mentioned?
I mean, there's some really simple research. There's tons of research now that shows that just being in nature, being proximal to nature, so even things like having a park within about a kilometre of home and obviously using it, really has some great effects on our general mental health. So there seems to be a really strong correlation with humans being in and interacting with nature, even if you're not necessarily paying attention to it, and reductions in anxiety, reductions in violence, reductions in levels of stress. And all of those things are just general functioning levels. But in the longer term, you know, we are synchronized very much with those patterns. And a great way of talking about that is to talk about sunlight. We have receptors on the sort of the bottom part of the back of our iris, which are primed for the infrared wavelengths that only a sunrise and a sunset will trigger. And they are linked almost directly with our endocrine system, our hormonal system, and that runs the circadian clocks in our body. So without seeing a sunrise, we rely on artificial light primarily to try and sort of set that clock. And often it does a really bad job because your body can't tell the difference between a halogen or a LED light in the middle of the day from one in the morning. So it often thinks if you're under sort of artificial light all day that you are sitting in the midday sun. And so it's really no wonder that we struggle often to go to sleep late at night because we're under artificial lights until quite late in the evening. And so the pattern was built, if you like, on a sunrise and a sunset. So they're simple things that everybody can do. And I'm sure Gina can probably talk about the importance of seeing the sun on her well-being whilst on shows like Alone. But it's no different for Antarctic expeditioners. It's no different for special forces operators in Afghanistan or other places like that. We run best when we run on the patterns that nature created for us. And it's often a case of relearning those things and then playing to those strengths rather than thinking, well, because I can sit under artificial lights all day, I should, and that's good for me and it won't have any impact. But nature has the master answer, if you like, the blueprint.
Going on that sunlight theme, I'm just thinking about in the Arctic Circle where you get periods where the sun rises for 30 minutes and then sets for 30 minutes or isn't there at all. Or like my time on Alone where I think I had, you know, there would be 10 days where I wouldn't necessarily see a sunrise or actual sunlight. Is it the quality of the light or does it have to be the sun? Boink, there it is.
It doesn't have to be the sun, and as we all know from our sunscreen lessons, UV will come through cloud and it reflects off things. So UV will get to your eyes as long as they're open and you know facing towards the sky. But there's a really fascinating part of this puzzle which we sort of haven't talked about, which is to do with our mitochondria. So our mitochondria, if you remember back to your year 11 sort of physics and PE lessons, are the powerhouse of the cells. You know, they produce ATP. Mitochondria aren't us. They're actually an enveloped bacterium, okay? So human particles aren't bacterium. They're human cells. So we enveloped this bacteria about 2 million years ago and formed a symbiotic relationship with us and formed mitochondria. Now, mitochondria have their own DNA. So we have two sets of DNA. We have cellular DNA, which is what our body sort of is structured and built according to, and then we have mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA come exclusively from your mum, from your mother's side. They're passed down 100% from your mother. And where your mother's mitochondrial DNA evolved in geographically predetermines how your energy system uses things like sunlight. So, for example, the Inuit in the northern sort of regions, right up in the polar regions, evolved mitochondria that adapted to low levels of sunlight. They also developed very white skin because melanin absorbs sunlight as well. And so really what you need to do if you want to know how much sunlight overall, what timings, how your body adapts from a seasonal perspective, you need to know where your mitochondrial DNA comes from. Now, mine comes from northern Siberia, which is probably why I've got fair skin and blue eyes, and I cook in the midday Australian sun like most Australians, most non-Indigenous Australians. But again, nature has the answer. It developed blueprints and adapted those mitochondrial DNA to suit those patterns that were where we lived. I guess the bit that gets really kooky about all of this is when that mitochondrial system breaks down, when we break those patterns, over the longer term, we now have evidence to show that it leads to mental health issues. Okay, so our mitochondria and our metabolism are closely linked. And most of the recent research on brain neurochemistry shows that when that system goes out of whack for the long term, for example, if you grow up under artificial lights and you never really see a sunrise and you eat a high refined carbohydrate diet, then guess what happens? Those mitochondria give out things called reactive oxygen species, which oxidize our brain chemistry and we end up with neurodegeneration. So the patterns in our brain start to break down. If you take it back to eco-psychology, this is saying, well, why are we functioning so poorly in society when we've disconnected from some of these basic patterns? Well, now there's some science to say, well, not only are we disconnecting from the patterns, but it's sort of slightly killing us. And we probably should take notice of some of those things and get back into some ways of living on the planet that are more synchronized with what nature actually wants us to do.
There's something about this. I'm just having a little bit of a giggle because I exist in some fairly out there hippie communities where yep. there's all sorts of sunlight practices. So there's the ones who get mm-hmm. up and like squint at the sun as it first comes over the horizon. But then there's the ones that kind of get naked and expose various bits to the sun yep. as well. And I'm sure that's not doing anything to the mitochondria. But
well, no, actually it is because we have skin receptors all over our body. Those skin receptors are designed to receive sunlight. It's not just our eyes. We were designed to be solar panels. We were designed to be maybe not naked, but certainly have a lot more of our skin exposed to sunlight. But look, you're right, Gina. I think there's a lot of traditional practices in First Nations, you know, around the world, which knew this stuff and they incorporated into cultural practices. They may not have known it explicitly at the quantum mechanical level, but they certainly knew it from a cultural perspective. Western science in the last 50 years has got too smart for itself, perhaps, and thought, oh no, we can bypass all those rules, or we can use medications or other forms of things to kind of put band-aids on them and push them back into form. But I don't think it's working that well for us.
Hmm.
Mark, I feel like we could go down so many rabbit holes with all this stuff. That was awesome. That was a great chat. I learned so much about myself and also so much about what participants of Alone are going through when they're out there. So, mate, thank you so much for your insights.
Absolute pleasure. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Lovely to see you, Mark.
Thanks for joining us on this podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, email alonepodcast@sbs.com.au and use the hashtag AloneAustralia on socials. Follow us on your podcast app to catch all the upcoming episodes when they drop, and we'll see you after the next episode.
This series is produced by SBS Audio. That's Caroline Gates, Max Gosford, Joel Supple, Karen Okuda, and Jung Cheng Ko. A huge thanks also to Joseph Maxwell, Alone Australia's executive producer, Rima Daya, and of course, all the participants.